Good evening, everyone. My name is Erwin Hochberg. I have the pleasure of knowing most of you, and the ones that do not know as yet, I'd like very much to meet and get to know. I am the chairman of the Executive Committee of the Middle East Forum, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this event. Unfortunately, my voice will carry. Just pay attention. Unfortunately, our host, David Adler, who is a partner at Osram Grumman, who's hosting this today, is out of town, but we are grateful to Osram Grumman for the hosting of this event and for the graciousness in providing the space and the lunch. He was unable to join us, therefore, so I would like to thank him and his colleagues for all of the help they've given us over the years. Before introducing our distinguished speaker, David Christ Jones, I would like to take a moment to tell you about the forum's important work and encourage you to join us in our activities. Under the direction of Daniel Pipes, the Middle East Forum works to define and promote American interests in the Middle East. That is our role. It has consistently displayed an unparalleled grasp of key issues, whether exposing the threat posed by radical Islam, working on the Palestinian acceptance of Israel, urging the Bush administration to better manage the democracy efforts, thinking through strategies to contain the Iranian threat, or critiquing the extended orthodoxy that dominates Middle East studies on North American universities. All of that encompasses the work of the Middle East Forum. And we are constantly expanding it as well. Through research, publishing, media work, and public education, including today's program, the forum energizes the public debate by addressing a range of issues and by offering fresh and sound perspectives on policy. If you have not done so already, I encourage you to add your name to the email sign-up list which we have provided for you outside to receive the Middle East Forum's publications. I also urge you to read the columns which appear in a syndicate of newspapers by Daniel Pipes, which I'm sure many of you do, but look for it and read it. You'll find it very informative and enlightening. Or you can get directly to the forum's website, www.MiddleEastForum.org, to sign up and read our work. I hope you find today's forum's efforts worthy of your support. I will just go through the formality of asking you to please shut off your cell phones. I think every time I say that, of my college days, when they said, make sure you have your own ashtray. But please shut off your phones so that you or none of us will be interrupted by it. I ask you to take a moment to think about this program and about what David Price Jones is going to tell you, because I think you'll find it totally absorbing. We're honored to host writer David Price Jones, who will discuss the book Betrayal, France, the Arabs, and the Jews. There are copies outside. You have seen them on your way in. It's hot off the press from Encounter Books. In this prescient and timely work, Mr. Price Jones argues that France has done more damage in the Middle East than any other external country, giving safe harbor to the Ayatollah Khomeini, supporting Saddam Hussein, and Yasser Arafat. In addition, France has encouraged the mass immigration of an Arab community with radical policies that Israel should be eliminated, for example, encouraged by the French, whose aggressive demands have influenced French policy and are spreading throughout an increasingly traumatized Europe. After today's program, copies of Betrayal will be available for purchases and signings by David Price Jones. David Price Jones has served as a senior editor of the National Review since 1999. You've seen his name, I know. You probably have read his materials. as I have, and I always look forward to getting them and reading them. He's also worked for the Daily Telegraph, Financial Times, which is the paper I read for aggravation, and the Spectator, while contributing frequently to such publications as The Times, The Wall Street Journal, Commentary, and The New Republic. Mr. Price-Jones was born in Vienna, educated at Oxford, and has taught at universities in California and Iowa. Extremely outstanding credentials. For more information, I suggest you visit his website, www.davidprice-jones, the same way you see his name spelled, .com. He's authored 9 novels and 12 books of nonfiction. The latter treats such themes as Middle Eastern policies, politics and culture, the fall of the Soviet Union, literary biography and criticism. His books have garnered acclaim for their insightful interpretations of major events. The Sunday Telegraph lauded Price-Jones' book, The War That Never Was, The Fall of the Soviet Empire. If you want to read just one book about how and why the whole Soviet Empire crumbled and fell, you should read this book. I commend it to you. It's a New York Times book review called The Closed Circle, another book. Excuse me, The Closed Circle, An Interpretation of the Arabs, a brilliant insight into the way Arab societies work. A healthy corrective, a thought-provoking study. While Daniel Pipes praised it as, and I quote what Daniel said, a landmark for understanding the politics of the Middle East. I ask you now, my friends, to welcome our guest, David Price-Jones.
Well, thank you very much. Whoever wrote those words for you was a master of spin. And he stopped short, that master of spin, telling you what the New York Times really said about the closed circle, because they jumped on it and tore it to bits. That was the only sentence of the review that was even bearable. The New York Times thinks that, I think if it acknowledges that I exist, it's probably because I got horns and a tail. But mostly it doesn't acknowledge my existence, and that's fine. I spend my day alone with my computer. So I'm very impressed that this all of you turned up to listen to me, and thank you very much. It's a great compliment to me. I'm really essentially a writer and not a speaker. I wanted in this book to examine the very strange behavior of the French. And it's a polemical book, it's a contentious book. I won't hide that fact. But I would be sorry if you thought that I was some kind of British flag waver who hated the French. It so happens I have a French grandfather, or had, I never knew him because he died before I was born, and I am a tricolor Frenchman. I would raise the flag of France. It's a great country. It's contributed a very great deal to civilization. It has a wonderful literature, very many wonderful Frenchmen. And the fact that the British have always felt the need to fight the French is not, I hope, relevant to my book. Now, the French are the authors of the Rights of Man. And the French invented the slogan, Liberté, Fraternité, Égalité, Liberty, Fraternity, and Equality. And this has entered, has it not, into the foundations of all of our democratic characters and spirit. So we need to understand, I think, why it is that in a moment of great crisis in the last 3 or 4 decades, the French have obstructed every Western initiative and policy, and although they declare themselves to be acting in the name of peace, they are in fact encouraging at best confusion and at worst war and violence. It's my view that we have a very serious confrontation with Islam now, we the West, and it's going to last for many years perhaps generations, there is something historic about it. Deep historic forces are working their way through. The Muslim world is very fragmented. And we can play on that. And it is in the end why we shall win. Because it's not a unified bloc. The Sunni and the Shia will not get their act together. And there are within the Sunni and the Shia all sorts of variations, and they will not get their act together either. So we're going to win this war. But it's only on condition that we, the West, stay united. And the French are fragmenting us and nullifying our efforts. Now, I became interested in French foreign policy when I came across this phrase, une puissance musulmane. La France est une puissance musulmane. France is a Muslim power. Well, for many centuries, France built itself as a Christian power. And it had its policies based upon protecting the Christians from the Holy Land, as it was then called, which, of course, was part of the Ottoman Empire. Around about the time, I can't exactly date it, but around about period when Napoleon III was ruling France, this phrase, La France est une puissance musulmane, a Muslim power, comes into current practice. And you find that it's repeated generation after generation by whatever the French regime is. De Gaulle talks about France as a puissance musulmane. Chirac talks about it as a puissance musulmane. It's a fantasy. France is not a Muslim power and can't be a Muslim power. What it is some kind of mirage that France can take advantage of the Muslims, can incorporate the Arabs and the Muslims into its imperial designs. And I think perhaps they borrowed the phrase, but I can't be sure, from the British, who at a certain point at about the same period thought of Britain as a Muslim power through India. But the British knew that we were not a Muslim power. We knew that what we were actually doing was ruling Muslims. And the French took maybe this idea, I can't exactly trace it. But what it means is that throughout the history of France dealing with the Arabs, they have thought that they could incorporate them into French foreign policy and French designs. There goes with that, a certain view of Jews. And that too goes back to the French Revolution, whereby the Comte de Clermont-Tonnerre in the Legislative Assembly said, to the Jews as individuals, everything, to the Jews as a nation, nothing. So that meant that the French, and that was passed into legislation. Now, it means that the French attitude towards Jews is defined by what the French think Jews ought to be and are, not what Jews think they are. I don't have to go over the history of the French dealings with Jews, but I found in the archives of the Quai d'Orsay an absolutely astonishing anti-Jewish animus that is repeated generation after generation. So you find that Jews were not allowed to work in the Quai d'Orsay as in French Foreign Ministry at all. You find that the bias against them is always that they cannot be acting independently. They have to be the instruments, the tools of somebody else. So that changes according to the circumstances of the day. Sometimes they're being used by the Russians, sometimes they're being used by the Germans, sometimes they're being used by the British. It gives the French a terrible, nasty surprise when Zionism appears on the scene. They can't believe it, because here are the Jews saying, we are a nation. And this goes against not only the French conception of Jews, but also legislation. So they do everything they can from the beginning to misinterpret Zionism and to stifle it. Zionism for the French, from the 1890s onwards, is a plot. It's either the British are taking advantage of these helpless Jews, or the Jews, in their malignity, are taking advantage of the British, or maybe it's some kind of anti-French scheme of the world powers. And so you find that French officials, one after another, repeat this extraordinarily fantastic interpretation of what's going on in the Arab world and in the Jewish world. One of the things that's most impressive about it is its continuity. It's very unusual to come across a French diplomat who disagrees with this view. So you find, to give you an example, General Gouraud comes to be French High Commissioner in Lebanon in 1920, and he's fulminating about against the British mandate, taking advantage of the Jews arriving and Zionism. This is terrible, it's going to hurt French interests horribly. He's succeeded by Bertrand de Jouvenel, who writes a dispatch in 1926 saying, when he arrived, he was really against Zionism and the Jews, but he's been down to look at Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and he's seen what's going on, and he envies the British High Commissioner because he's got these productive and creative people at his disposal. Why don't the French do the same? He's almost the only voice you can find who talks like that, you know, at that time. But of course, it's very serious because they block all initiatives to create a Jewish state. And you see important French officials who believe rubbish. Now, this is really the paradox of the thing. They're intelligent men. They're some of the most intelligent men of their time. And they had access to all the information that was available. They're sophisticated people. It's not that they're really anti-Semitic in the classical sense, although some of them are. I mean, there are people like Paul Morand, who's a French ambassador, or Jean Giraudoux in the Foreign Office, French Foreign Office. Claudel. There are such people, but what is extraordinary, I think, is that there's an institutional way of thinking, institutional mindset, and it can only be that the senior people in the Quai d'Orsay get over the junior people and teach them what the house rules are, and so it perpetuates itself. Well, they voted against the creation of the State of Israel. They refused to recognize it de jure, although they recognized it de facto because they had to. And there came this brief interlude in the 1950s when suddenly they had a moment of realpolitik because Arab nationalism threatened the French position in North Africa. It wasn't the Jews who threatened the French position, of course, which is what they've been saying for 100 years. It was the Arabs. Israel was also threatened by Arab nationalism under Nasser, so there was a coincidence of interest for a brief period. And it's very curious to see how the Quai d'Orsay tried to stop the Ministry of Defense where this pro-Israeli attitude was developed. France was selling arms to Israel at that point, and that occurred, as you know, the 1956 campaign, when for this brief interlude, France was an ally and a genuine supporter of Israel, but within French ruling circles, there was this big clash. The Quai d'Orsay never admitted that the Ministry of Defense had a right to its policy, and they did whatever they could to block it. After the Suez campaign, you can see the Quai d'Orsay is determined to regain the initiative for French foreign policy. And after 1958, when General de Gaulle comes back, he is converted to the Quai d'Orsay viewpoint, although he never actually respected the Quai d'Orsay much. And French foreign policy reverts to its anti-Israeli position. It was consummated in 1967, if you remember, when literally overnight, I mean, it was like a George Orwell 2 minute hate. The French just switched from being supporters of Israel to being outright opponents of Israel. And General de Gaulle at that time made the famous speech that the Jews were people sûr de lui-même, dominateur, dominating, confident. And he went on in that speech, a bit that isn't quoted much, which goes on to say something like, wherever they live, they draw upon themselves their misfortunes. And at the same time, he said to the British Prime Minister, and this is what he believed, British Prime Minister Harold Wilson, he said, from now on you will see the only Western power which has any influence with the Arabs and the Muslims will be France. So from 1967 onwards, French foreign policy has been based upon their view that they're influencing the Arabs and the Muslims and excluding the State of Israel. Every subsequent Prime Minister, President, I mean to say, from de Gaulle, has stayed within those guidelines. There's been a little bit more and a little bit less, but the guidelines remain constant, whether it's been Pompidou or Mitterrand, Giscard. And now Chirac. It's meant that France has based its foreign policy pillars, in particular, they first began to try with Gaddafi. But Gaddafi is too unstable a figure to base any policy on, and it didn't work. They sold him 110 Mirages that they'd actually sold to Israel, but they sold a second time to Libya, and refused to, because they have an arms sanction on Israel. But Gaddafi they couldn't do, so they chose Saddam Hussein instead, and Yasser Arafat. These are the two pillars of French foreign policy. Now, it's both Saddam and Arafat run strictly counter to every value that France has ever produced in itself. And these are not men of liberté, égalité, and fraternity. They really aren't. They're a couple of bloodstained tyrants. And they've done nothing but damage to their own people. And yet, France has given Saddam Hussein every opportunity. It's about the only foreign country Saddam ever visited. He went several times to France, twice in 1975. And Chirac, who was then Prime Minister, sold him a nuclear plant, which the Israelis had to destroy in 1982. They sold billions of arms to Iraq. They were responsible for the arms which killed the Kurds, killed the Shia. Bernard Kouchner, who was a decent man, Médecins Sans Frontières, promoting him on a trip to Iraq, he said it was a strange business to be in Iraq in 1976, I think it was, and to find French bombs raining on his own head. But that was the case. France was the first country to open a PLO office in Europe, and Pompidou, then the president, thought he had some gentleman's agreement with the PLO that they would not use terror in France. But it didn't work like that. If you remember, they shot Hamshari, the PLO representative in Paris, some Palestinian gunman. When Abu Daoud, the man who'd been responsible for killing Israelis at the Munich Olympic Games, arrived for some doctors, we're told, some medical reason in Paris, he was arrested because there was a warrant out for him, because he's a killer. And a few days later, the Quai d'Orsay just put him on a plane out, without any regard for due process whatsoever. And I could repeat that sort of incident many times over. The French thought they had to deal with Iran. But this was vitiated because they were selling arms to Iraq, and the Iranians didn't like it. So the Iranians started using terror on the streets of France. I have the figures in the book. In my memory, I think it's something like 16 people were gunned down in the streets of France, and over 100 were injured with bombs and things. Because the Iranians wanted to teach the French a lesson. You don't sell arms to Iraq when we're fighting Iraq. And Mitterrand couldn't understand this. Mitterrand kept on saying, but we have friends in Iraq and we love you in Iran too. Well, take some corpses and find out. The French, if you remember, received Imam Khomeini, in 1978. No country would take him. And he was preaching against the Shah. And it was obvious he was about to have an insurrection. But France took him in, and France promoted him, and France returned him on an Air France plane to Iran to take over from the Shah. And the French thought that this would be profitable to them. But what they've actually done, by returning Khomeini in the way in which they did and promoting him and allowing him to free operations in France, was to facilitate what is certainly the most important revolution of modern times, which is the Iranian Revolution. It's the Iranian Revolution that has unlocked the war on terror against us. And it's the French who made it possible to do so. When he was at Neuf-le-Château, outside Paris, I haven't been there, but I believe it's about 10 kilometers outside Paris, they made telex lines available to him and so on. He was constantly in touch with Iran, giving instructions to how to mobilize demonstrations and force the Shah out. The French role in that, I tell it in the book, is pretty much the same as the French role in returning Haji Amin, the Mufti of Jerusalem, to the Middle East when he was wanted as a war criminal in 1945. So twice now the French have made sure that the Western world is seriously handicapped by Muslim monsters. Haji Amin and Khomeini were both monsters, who both of them, they're fascists, they both of them believe that force is the solution of the problem. Now, underneath this foreign policy, I mustn't go on too long, must I? Underneath this foreign policy, there's been the immigration of Muslims and Arabs into France. There weren't any Muslims in France, really, until the Second World War. Muslims had fought loyally for France. There were 100,000 Muslims in the French army in the First World War, and they were rewarded by being given permission to build the Great Mosque of Paris in 1926, the first mosque of its sort. And the imam is an Algerian. But there wasn't really any, it was just a token. But after the Second World War, and especially when things go wrong in Algeria, rightly, understandably, Algerians wanted to flee, and they came for safety to France. They wanted to better themselves. And the situation changed in 1974 when French rights of residence and welfare state rights and so on, benefits, were granted to everybody. And then, of course, that acted as a magnet. And since when, there's been enormous immigration of Arabs and Muslims into France. Today, we think that the figure is about 6 million, or 10% of the population, 60 million Frenchmen. But that doesn't include illegal immigration, and it seems pretty certain that it's an understated figure. Although there are demographers who say it's an overstated figure, it's not clear, because in the French census they don't ask you what your religion is. They're not assimilated, and there's very little effort to assimilate them. They live in les banlieues, the suburbs of, altogether in these high-rise buildings, which are, if you ever go there, extraordinarily dispiriting. And unemployment in quite a lot of these places reaches 60%, 70%. And crime comes in with it, and these people deal in drugs. And they are really creating a society of their own, apart from the French. You saw what happened last year, when the French police, in an unimportant incident of itself, chased a couple of teenagers, and they jumped across a wall into some electrical station and were electrocuted. There were explosions all over France in 300 cities and towns, and the rioting went on for weeks on end. Very few people were killed, luckily, only very few, and probably mostly by accident. Somebody was lynched. A lot of people got hurt. And in the course of the year, I give the figure in betrayal, it's something like 110,000 cars and vehicles were burnt out. 110,000. And I think it's safe to say that the French state lost control of these people, and lost control to the street, to the Muslim street. From the Jewish point of view, this is a very serious matter, because the French state is now critical of Israel, and does whatever it can to impede Israeli foreign policy and Israeli measures of self-defense, while at the same time appeasing and surrendering to the Muslims. So my argument is that two things have now come into collision in France. The idea that France is in puissance musulmane, Muslim power, and the idea that Jews have no nationality. And these two main defining ideas are now in collision, and they are leading to a sense of supremacy, victory on the part of the Muslims, and defeat and fear on the part of the Jews. And you will remember some of these Jewish reactions are very reminiscent of the 30s. I mean, Sharon said, Jews should now emigrate. They couldn't live in France anymore. Rabbi Sitruk in Paris said that Jews shouldn't wear a yarmulke in the street anymore because they can be recognized. There's been nothing like that, really, since the days of Hitler. The Jews should actually hide their identity in the street. And it matters now because a great test is coming, in my view, which will be a test of our whole civilization. What is the future of Iran? It threatens genocide. And it doesn't threaten genocide in some kind of extravagant way. It threatens it in a methodical, daily way. And it mobilizes huge crowds, 2 or 3 million people, shouting death to the Jews, death to the Americans. And these are, if you like, Nuremberg rallies. So, in the face of a threat like that, clearly, huge decisions of a historic kind are going to have to be taken. Here is France refusing to take the kind of protective measures that even the United Nations would allow. The French don't want sanctions. The French want talks about holding talks. In other words, they've given way to Iran. And they want us to give way to Iran. And the choice is narrowing itself down to the very unpleasant duality. It's either surrender or bomb. And it's clear that the French want us to surrender. They believe that we can live with a genocidal state of this kind. And we saw how in the July fighting in the Middle East, France didn't exactly take the side of Hezbollah, but it found justification, and it kept on criticizing Israel. It was France that was the first country to produce this accusation that Israel's policy was disproportionate, the response was disproportionate. It was disproportionate, as a matter of fact, but in the wrong sense. It should have been infinitely stronger. But now, France is protecting the Hezbollah. And the French Foreign Ministry and the French Ministry of Defense is criticizing Israel for such protective measures as sending unmanned aircraft and flights over Hezbollah territory for intelligence purposes. I mean, if the French were in the same position, just imagine what they would be doing. But here they are, trying to impede Israel. Now, I think that what has happened, to understand how French have got into this muddle, was the purpose of betrayal. And I have just followed out the way in which they have taken this position that the Jews do not deserve a nation, are not a nation, and can't ever be a nation, while everything must be done to incorporate the Arabs and Muslims into the French nation. And this seems to me the basis, really, of how the French have got into the muddle they have got into. I don't think France is an anti-Semitic nation. I don't think a nation can be anti-Semitic. Although, interestingly, when I was very young, I was in Israel, and it came to Ben-Gurion's attention that there was this young English writer there, and it amused him. And he was very nice to me, and he picked me up and took me to this, that, and the other, and I went to Mapai meetings under Ben-Gurion's auspices. And one day he said to me, "What's the most anti-Semitic nation in the world?" So I said, "Well, I suppose the Germans." "Wrong," he said, "the French." And I haven't ever forgotten that. So I trace it out in my book, but I actually think it isn't exactly anti-Semitism as such, although the effect may be the same. It's just that they believe their own fairy tale. And if I can point out that these are fairy tales, well, then I've done something, and I've talked much too long. I'm so sorry. I should have stopped it.
Okay. good remarks. We have time for several questions in the back.
Do you think that the next election, if Sarkozy wins, since he has already expressed things that are less anti-Israeli than Chirac, things may change one way or another?
Yes, I do. Sarkozy believes that you must use the CRS, the French police, and the French judiciary. I mean, France has got the apparatus if it can find the political will. The French are a great deal tougher than the British when it comes down to. And there are some examples. If you remember Maurice Papon, who played this malign role in French history, but he was responsible for allowing the murder of 100 Algerians whose corpses were thrown into the Seine. So, you know, the French have got form, as they say. So I think if Sarkozy gets elected, he spoke about the rioters as racailles, which is a strong word, scumbags. And Villepin is the opposite. Villepin believes that you buy them off. Villepin wanted to give them $17 billion worth of benefits and welfare and community centers and all these, you know, all the other things that just get on corrupting people.
You mentioned that the Iranian Revolution is the fault of France. It is just as much our fault, if not more, under Carter, because I once spoke to the head of the CIA at that time, I forget his name, and he said the biggest mistake we ever made was to foster and permit this revolution to get Khomeini into power.
Carter was a disaster. And he made a terrible mistake in dealing with it. I mean, shortly before the Shah fell, Carter made a speech saying that the Shah was a great trusted ally of the United States and doing a wonderful job. And he sent his ambassador, his name was Sullivan, he sent Ambassador Sullivan to the Shah in, it was certainly the fall and possibly even as late as December 78, to tell the Shah under no circumstances to shoot, because the Shah said, if I kill 5,000 rioters, this whole situation will be restored. I can stay on. But if I don't, I'm finished. And Ambassador Sullivan was sent on instructions from Carter, saying, under no circumstances shoot. And Carter then couldn't make up his mind if he wanted to keep the Shah or didn't want to keep the Shah. So he changed his opinion all the time. And he kept on ringing Giscard up in Paris, saying, keep the Khomeini, let him go, keep him, let him go. Oh, I can't make up my mind. And they all went to Guadeloupe. There was a big, big meeting in Guadeloupe, and Carter just threw his hands in. It was a pitiful performance.
Yes.
But if the French had kept Khomeini back, yeah, all they had to do was say, I'm sorry, there's trouble with your tourist visa, and you have to be arrested. And what was Mrs. Khomeini doing all that time? It's very amusing. Mrs. Khomeini spent every day in Lanvin, the couturier, buying dresses.
While completely agreeing with your conclusions, I'd like just to point out that the statement about true the Jews as individuals, everything, nation, nothing, was in fact an act of emancipation relative to the history of the time. But what I don't understand, and perhaps you can explain the contradiction to me, is why is it that France, which I happen to believe is more anti-Jewish than you do, not just anti-Zionist, but anti-Jewish, why is it that in France the Jews have politically gone further than in the United States or in Great Britain, for example, you had Léon Blum and Mondes France, you then had Fobius, and now you have Sarkozy, who apparently is a Jewish. I see that as a contradiction, and whenever I argue with my French friends about their history, they certainly point to the political leaders as being quite effective, their major political leaders, rather, as being Jewish.
Well, don't forget Disraeli.
I didn't forget him. he was baptized as a Protestant.
Yes. If the Jews have, you're right, it was an act of emancipation at the time because it freed them from the ghetto, and Napoleon insisted on doing that, and quite a lot of Orthodox Jews at the time were not happy about it. because they wanted to stay with the rabbi in Kurland in Russia, who said, I'm going to the Tsar. It's a difficult question, but I think myself that the French did believe that Jews had rights as people. And you are giving me ammunition for that theory. But remember the anti-Semitism that people like Blum received, and remember the Dreyfus case, and remember Vichy, and remember the persecution that Jews have had, and maybe we shouldn't be too optimistic.
Do the French see themselves eventually absorbing the Muslims and the Muslims giving up their religious persuasions and attitudes? Do they see them ultimately assimilate as French? How does the street generally view this situation?
It hangs in the balance. The Muslims have clearly got to, and the Arabs have clearly got to make a choice. They're either going to assimilate or separate. They've got a choice. And I would have said before 9/11 that they more or less made that choice, that they were going to assimilate. But suddenly after 9/11 it looks different. It looks as if you don't want to assimilate to the losers. You want to run with the winners. And if really Bin Laden is going to win, and Khomeini is going to win, and there's going to be a great Muslim revival, what do we need to assimilate for? So there are voices in their midst who say, we're going to have the Sharia, and we're going to have control of these people, and the green flag of Islam is going to fly over the Élysée and Downing Street and the White House. So those voices sound to us like lunatics. And dangerous lunatics who threaten us with civil war. But meanwhile, if you were a moderate Muslim and you were just a chap on the street, you'd keep your head down. You wouldn't stick it up above the parapet because you might get hit by your own side by some fire-eating imam who says, you know, join the jihad, or you might be hit by the police. And so they're frightened and they don't know which way to jump. There are some very sinister people. I mean, Abu Jaja in Antwerp wants a European-wide Muslim movement in which all the Muslims in all the countries would unite and jihad. Now, you know, the Swedish Minister of Welfare, whose name I can't now remember, said we must be nice to the Muslims when we're the majority so that they're nice to us when they're the majority. Well, if that mentality wins, you know, the Muslims will be ruling us pretty soon. Because I'm really inwardly quite a cheerful fellow, I find it impossible to believe that, you know, my wife's going to be eventually in a burqa and I might have my hands cut off. So I just can't believe it. But there are people who hold it in store for us.
What does the Frenchman in the street, non-Muslim Frenchman, say?
Well, in my judgment, what he thinks is, let's kill him quick. What does the Frenchman in the street think? You know, and the answer is, we have to get them before they get us. And I think that's what the German in the street thinks, and what the Briton in the street thinks, and what they all think. But our leaders don't. And for reasons that are completely obscure, but must go to the root of the problem of today, political correctness applies everywhere. And we're not allowed to talk like this. We're not allowed to say these things. And if I was to say them in public, God knows what would happen to me.
Except Australia.
Mm?
Except Australia.
Except Australia. Except Australia. But you're not allowed to talk like that. And, you know, I mean, give you an example, just over the Danish cartoons. About 1,000 Muslims turned up to demonstrate in the centre of London, shouting and holding up placards saying, kill the infidels, behead the Christians. So a man gets out of a van and goes over to the police and says, that's incitement to murder, arrest them. And the police say, if you're not out of here straight away, we'll arrest you. So, you know, this has to come from the top. There has to be instructions from the Home Office or the Prime Minister's Office or whoever it is that we mustn't do anything to rock the boat. And if you ask me the reason for this, the only reason I can think of, anyhow, is fear. That we're afraid of the Muslims. And we're so afraid of them that we're not going to arrest them when they break the law. We're going to privilege them. So now, I don't believe, I mean, this is because, like I said, I'm a cheerful fellow. I don't believe the man on the street could possibly accept that. And the longer the delay, the greater the likelihood of violence, and the worse the violence will be when it comes. I had another extraordinary example the other day. I mean, Somalia is the latest place that's going down the tube, because Etihad, they're like Al-Qaeda, they're taking over Somalia. So we'll have troops in Somalia pretty soon now. 500 Somalis rioted in London. And they went down the Edgware Road, smashing up shops and leaving the shopkeepers unconscious. The police came and hushed the story up. And I was told this by the man on the county council, to whom the police had come and said, we're not going to do anything about this. It was just a temporary thing and just a disturbance, and let it be. So, you know, they're not held responsible for their actions. And if they're not held responsible, it means the law is disregarded, which means that they'll do it again. And next time, maybe they'll kill people. I can't explain it, but it has to be, we were afraid of those 500 people and what they do, and we were also afraid of our own people, that the native English would go out and kill the Somalis. So, out of fear of the repercussions and what would happen, a horrible situation is allowed to build up.
My question, sir, and I enjoyed the presentation tremendously. I want to thank you. The pan-Euro-Arab movement, which is happening, how will it affect the European common market, and how will it affect their economics throughout Europe and into the rest of the world?
Well, both Arabs and Jews are at a disadvantage in the European Union, because the European Union fundamentally wants to break up the nation state. And that's what it aims to do. And that is the basic premise of the whole experiment. But they're creating, out of the dark recesses of history, where thank God they've been buried, all sorts of small and nasty people. The Basques, the Irish Republicans, the Burgundians, the Corsicans, we don't want them. The nation state has kept them in their place for very sound reasons. But they're all coming out of the woodwork now, and they're going to be given regional autonomy. Catalans are the latest. Well, the Arabs don't have a regional basin, nor do the Jews. And so those are the two people who are excluded from this European pattern. Now, I personally am absolutely convinced that the European Union will break up. It goes against too many human things. It's like communism. Communism couldn't work because it goes against all sorts of fundamental human questions of identity and who you think you are and who you think the other person is. And the common market, the European Union, is doing the same. But if it doesn't break up, there's going to be a lot of trouble for both Arabs and Jews.
Thank you.
In Europe?
My question is, obviously there is a great disconnect between the European government and their people. In your assessment, where is that tipping point when people say enough of this? You know, we're either going to have to destroy them or they're going to destroy us, meaning the Arabs versus the Muslims versus the Christian community in Europe.
Yes. Well, God forbid that there should be another 9/11, but if there is, that would be the tipping point. I mean, you saw in Holland how the nature of the country changed when Van Gogh was murdered, if that's how you pronounce it. I mean, poor man, it was a disgusting piece of butchery. And the Dutch, which, you know, this was the most liberal country perhaps in the world. You know, pornography was obligatory, wasn't it? And, drugs also. So, it's changed. if a thing like that happens again in any of these countries, and it's always been frustrated. Thank God, I mean, the police are getting better, and we are using counterintelligence more effectively. But you mentioned the intelligentsia, you know. The next book I'm going to write is an expose of the intelligentsia. Because they've let us down. They've let us down like the French have let us down.
Before you let me out in a fit of gloom and despair, do you see any... just one question. There is a quote attributed to George Orwell. I know it's true. Some ideas, which are so stupid, so idiotic, so absurd, only intellectuals could believe them.
That is a genuine quotation of Orwell's, and he is an exception to the rule. He's a wonderful man.
You see any hope for the future?
Well, look, I do, because the weakness of democracy is that the people who put themselves forward to represent us nearly always have psychological flaws. They are not expressing our interests, but their ambitions. And they are inadequate people. And it's become worse lately because now we have people. The whole British cabinet, which has gone to war, there's not one man in it who's ever worn a uniform. There's not one man in it who's ever run a business. What the hell do they know about things? And they're all of them so many egos with legs. They're just walking, you know. And that's true about all these people. They're egos with legs. So, and it's embarrassing, isn't it? And this is the weakness of democracy. But I don't believe myself that ordinary people fall so easily into this decline. And I think, you know, I told you, I'm a cheerful person. You know, I think the man on the street is okay. And I mean, for example, you know, the British soldiers or the American soldiers in Iraq seem to me to be terrific men.
I ask a question. There was an article in Sunday's New York Times about the convergence of nuclear issues with suicide bombing. I don't know if you read this. By Noah Feldman.
Oh, yes.
And basically, I don't know well, but Noah talked about essentially the Muslim world's interest in nuclear technology. It really is another form of destruction of another form of suicide bombing of an extreme nature. And it would seem, I'd like to hear your views of how do you stop this process? Because obviously all these issues you're talking about, whether it's in France or other parts of Europe, are really symptoms of radical destruction and terrible, terrible conflict with the West, and particularly towards America. And we're inevitably moving towards a process that could be extremely dangerous that the public may not even appreciate the magnitude of the danger. I'm wondering, what do you think should be done now to stop it? Because if you're not going to stop it now, what you're really implying is that this whole issue magnifies itself where it becomes almost unstoppable at some point.
Well, I think, like I said at the very beginning, I mean, deep historic forces are at work. I mean, it's been about 200 years now when the Muslims have seen that they are inadequate to deal with the modern world. They can't do it. And every so often, the disjunction between what's going on in the West and what's going on in the Muslim world becomes unbearable. And then there's an intervention from the part of the West. I mean, Bonaparte is in 1798, Gladstone in 1882, the British again in the first after the First World War, Mr. Bush now. It's because if the Muslims keep on falling behindhand, their resentment and their hate builds up until it becomes something that's threatening to us.
It would seem a Marshall Plan or some type of involvement. Rather than a destructive process, what you're really talking about is putting a lid on them every time. and the bubble gets bigger and bigger.
Yes, we have to find some way to stabilize it, don't we? And I don't think they can do it for themselves. And the reason, in the end, it seems to me that Mr. Bush is justified in going into Iraq is that if they can't form some kind of civil society for themselves, we have to do it for them. And that is the only way out, I think. But I do also believe that the 1979 Khomeini Revolution is at least as important as the Bolshevik Revolution, at least as important, because it liberates this hatred and it gives it an arena in which to operate. And you can see straight away what the reaction was, that the Saudis, who are Sunni, have wanted to match the Shia release of hatred and resentment. So you've now got two sources of within the Arab world, or the Muslim world, the Sunni source and the Shia source. And it's mobilizing an enormous amount of historic hatred and resentment. And that's why they're shouting death to the Americans and death to the Jews. I'm not sure that any psychiatrist can deal with such a mass phenomenon. I mean,
that's all about psychiatrists.
Well,
that's
right. It is obviously some kind of moral breakdown, isn't it? The minute that you start shouting en masse for murder, you've lost your moral compass. And they've lost their moral compass. And now the only way that I can see to do anything about that, I'm afraid, is to assert your military superiority, that you're not going to allow moral anarchy to rule. Because if we have moral anarchy, we're all finished. And we aren't moral anarchists and we aren't morally chaotic ourselves. So this is why I don't see any alternative to what we are actually doing. A Marshall Plan is probably, will be just seen as, helping Swiss banks.
The problem, the only last point I'd like to make is that this footprint in France that exists, this 5 or 6 million Muslims in France, and the footprint in London, and all this hatred, it's also within America. They're here too. And eventually this will unleash here in the United States as well.
Well, as far as I can tell, the Muslim immigrants here are much more willing to enter the melting pot and to do what immigrants to the United States have always done, which is sit down, work, and build. And there is such a thing, it seems to me, as an American Muslim, in which there isn't such a thing, really, as a French Muslim. They're all Muslims there.
Final question.
Isn't it inevitable that eventually, as the pace continues the way it is right now, that you will have religious wars with an identity crisis beginning spreading to the Netherlands and Germany and all of Western Europe? In fact, together with, as I said before, with the identity crisis of Western Europe eventually leading to religious wars and psychological blocks as far as religion and the religious aspect of the whole thing is concerned. That we will have religious wars in Germany, in Western Europe, at this
place, right now. Well, we certainly have a religious war in the Middle East, don't we?
Right.
Hezbollah Israeli clash is a religious war, and the Hamas Israeli clash is also fueled by religion. It's unfortunately.
Isn't it inevitable that you're going to have an identity crisis in Western Europe? It has to come. That combined with religious wars, as it says.
Well, I think political correctness has produced an identity crisis. Because the tenets of political correctness are such that we're not allowed to discuss things truthfully any longer. And if you can't discuss things truthfully, you have an identity crisis. I mean, why am I obliged to conceal the truth? Who am I if I'm suppressing the truth? And what you say is very conceivable. I think it would take the form of some kind of neo-fascism. It would be a sort of like what happened in the breakup of Yugoslavia. The Muslims will be just put on ships. If it comes to that. If they don't assimilate, they'll go to Marseille and be shipped off to Algeria. And they didn't start in Algeria, that's where they'll finish.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much for your time.